And also, of course, thanks to the Institute for inviting me. It's really nice to be here. Very noble, actually. Okay, but what I want to present today is just some kind of funny observation that me and our group made recently. That's me, Robert Hübner. Then Andrea Mari and our boss, Jens Eisert. We are working in Berlin. So if you are there and interested in this, please visit us. Yeah. Okay, to start with, I give you the statement that I want to make right away. The statement is that generically, I will give a definition of this a bit later. In the thermodynamic limit and for translation and invariant situations, an important class of states called the matrix product states in the discrete and continuous version, they allow for a Wick theorem. But this Wick theorem is based on three-point function and not on two-point functions. So why should you be interested? Wick's theorem is a well-known theorem for Gaussians. In statistics, it tells you that you can derive all the moments of a Gaussian probability distribution from the second moments alone. And similarly, in physics, it tells you that the endpoint functions of Gaussian states are completely determined by the two-point function. This has important consequences in field theory. For example, the Feynman diagrams are linked to this. Our whole picture of what's going on, virtual particles and so on, is partially based on this property of Gaussian states, which are the ground states of free theories. So now MPS, on the other hand, are totally unlike Gaussian states. They are close to important ground states, nevertheless. Roughly speaking, they describe one-dimensional settings and when the entanglement saturates. I will come to this later. And you might think of the ground states of locally interacting gapped Hamiltonians in one dimension. The keyword here is interacting. Usually you deal with ground states of the free theory, which are Gaussian, but the MPS, as I said, are not of this kind. So it's even more surprising that you have a structural theorem like Wick's theorem in this kind of state. Now we think this might have implications for diagrammatic methods like Feynman diagrams and so on, also on the reconstruction of field states like light beams and for open quantum systems and also statistics, where structures like MPS are known as the hidden Markov models and widely used. Okay, for the audience which is not so familiar with matrix product states, I will give a short introduction so they have an idea what I'm talking about and don't have to go to sleep right now. Okay, it's not complicated. Imagine a state of 8 spins. You know, you can write all pure states in this form with a coefficient in front of these basis states, and you sum over all these vectors. Now, you can make a picture of this. You have this coefficient, and it's a tensor. It has connections to all the spins. Looks like this. Now, imagine you split this tensor up into two tensors, which are linked by a new unphysical index that you sum over, then you get the same state in this form. Now you have written this one tensor in form of two with a new index which both share and which you sum over. You can do this with all states that you like, obviously, so there is no restriction that you're making here to any of any kind. Yeah, behind this split is the singular value decomposition. So imagine you take the tensor and then you group indices like this, two groups, then you have a matrix. And now you can, of course, make a singular value decomposition of this matrix. It gives you a unitary here, a unitary there, and some diagonal there. You can absorb this diagonal into the both unitaries or into one of them, however you like. And then you're left with these two tensors. So that's what's behind it. And now these singular values here, they are on a physical perspective, from a physical perspective, they are interesting. They contain a lot of important information about the bipartition of the system. If you order them by magnitude, then for a lot of physical interesting situations, like when the state is a ground state, for example, then you observe that they decay very quickly. And so even if you discard the singular values which have small magnitude, you can describe the state in a way that is norm close to the original state that you wanted to describe. Moreover, these values have operational meaning in quantum information. They can tell you if you can, with local operations, transform one state into the other, but this is not so meaningful in this context. However, maybe keep in mind that this method which uses this splitting can be seen as a relaxation of the mean field method. Now, if you do this repeatedly, then in the end you might end up in a situation where you have one tensor for each physical site. And you can do this with open ends or closed periodic boundary conditions. And these states then are the states that belong to the very famous DMRG, density matrix renormalization group method. And they are very accurate in the description of the ground states of local interacting Hamiltonians. And you observe that you need very few parameters to describe the state. Actually, it's an exponential decrease. And you also have efficient access to expectation values in these states. So all in all, when you have a certain situation, a certain Hamiltonian, then you can use these states to describe the situation very well. That's the upshot. So it's not just a very strange class of states, but it's actually a very meaningful one. So to prepare the theorem, which, by the way, I think I will not give in all details, but just an instructive example instead. But to prepare this, I give a bit more of a background. If there are any questions related to what I'm saying, please just ask. So what I just showed you is the construction or how to come up with this kind of state. Here you find the trace. Those boundary conditions. And here are the tensors. Now, because you have three indices, you can write them as matrices with one open index coupling to the physical side. Yeah, and in this example, there's a new particle spin system. These are the tensors characterizing the state. And keep in mind that the bond dimension of the matrices, that's the matrix dimension, is arbitrary but fixed in this situation. Okay. Now the talk is about the correlation functions in these states, so I better give them. Imagine you have operators O placed at these positions here.
It's my fault for coming late. I had something else. Is this a one-dimensional chain or?
Yes.
So it's specifically one-dimensional.
Basically, one dimension. Of course, you can put such a chain also in higher dimensional settings, but then, of course, the scaling properties will not be so favorable. Yeah. Okay, so these correlation functions are expressed as a trace, like here, where you have operators M. These are versions of this local operator that we put on these sides here. And not only these operators appear, but this e to the n matrices, which are transfer matrices. They are also derived from the A matrices, and basically they control all the correlations that you observe. Yeah. When you normalize the state, then e to the infinity is a meaningful limit. Yeah. And keep in mind that this n here encode the distances between these places where I apply operators.
So it's that these O's, the O operators are different from side to side, right?
In this, to not overload notation, okay, at this point, I chose them to be the same. There are enough indices already.
This but, formula just follows from the formula on the top if you plug it in.
Yes, exactly. Shall I dwell on this a bit?
I think it's fine.
Yeah, okay. It's not so difficult. I mean, what you're doing is basically something like psi and then say O something O. Another psi, which is sum over some spins S, and let's call the others T. Then you have these trace formulas, A, S, this one belongs to the bra. Then you have some that are cats. And then, of course, you have the matrix, the basis states. You see, I chose local operators here. You can, of course, expand all operators in this local form. And then this expression is something like delta S nu T nu, et cetera, except where O is actually acting. Where you have an application of O, let's say at I, you will sum over T I and S I, and you will have like this. Okay, now what do we do with the trace? I mean, we know, say we have trace A, trace B. This is trace A tensor B, like this. And then when we have a trace of, say, AB tensor CD, then this is now, of course, you can pull this complex conjugation of this number into the trace. All matrix elements are conjugated. And then when you sum over these things, you can perform the sum locally. Then where no operator is acting, you get simply, because of the delta, you get an S. All these places like this. And where you have an operator acting, you get these matrices and this expression, because there these things do not cancel. Okay. Good. Now, let's define the term generic that I used in the formulation of the theorem. I give you this formula here, so you don't have to remember it. Now, you see that if you perform a simultaneous conjugation of all the matrices with some kind of an invertible matrix, then this expression doesn't change. So obviously, it's a gauge transformation. Yeah. For example, we can think of a Jordan transformation of the matrix E, the transfer matrix. OK. Now, when do we call the MPS that belongs to the A matrices, when do we call it generic? Now, if this Jordan transformation doesn't give us a non-degenerate spectrum. And moreover, if the largest magnitude among the eigenvalues occurs only once. These are almost all cases that one can have. If you randomize matrices, you will almost with certainty find such a generic case. and very close to in every epsilon neighborhood of any non-degenerate MPS, there are generic MPS. So that's almost always the case. For physical applications in a lab or so, you will have the generic case. You can be sure of this.
Can you just explain, the superscript, the n minus 1?
This here?
Yeah.
This is an exponentiation of the transfer matrix to the distance between the two operators, m and m. Shall I go back? You see, here between these operators, we have a certain distance coming from this support of the operators. They are one-side operators. And in this n, I encode the distance like this. Say side 5 and side 1, then you have a distance of 4 between them. And the transfer matrix E here enters 4 times in between. That's all there is. Okay. Now, the main result. Okay, we have the following situation. In general, if we want to know a state, it is necessary and sufficient to know all the correlation functions. Okay. But one may ask the question, like for the ground states of the free theory where this is possible, one may also ask the question here, is it possible to completely characterize the state from only low order correlation functions? You remember in the free theories, you have this Gaussian structure, and then you know from Wick's theorem that you can derive all endpoint functions from the two-point function. Now the question is, can I do something similar in this case? And this is a very generous situation, right? You just limit the L spectrum in these bipartitions. This is a limitation of the entanglement of the state. But on the other hand, we know that very important Hamiltonians, I mean, for example, the Heisenberg chain, Hamiltonians like this, they have matrix product states as ground states. So, okay, so we ask this question for these states again. And the statement of my talk is that, okay, if somebody gives you the guarantee that your state has a bond dimension, a matrix dimension, or a Schmidt rank in the bipartition of maximum D, then you can find out first that you have a generic MPS just from measurements, which is nice. Because if you know that it is generic and one other thing that I will show later, then you can really reconstruct the state only from low order correlation functions. Which order depends a bit on your operators, but again, this is a statement where for almost all states and for almost all operators, it's true that it is only the three-point function. So we have a bit of a situation that is very similar to the Gaussian states, just we need the three-point function. Okay, how can one see this? Again, the formula for the correlation functions. And now we want to perform a Z-transformation. A Z-transformation is something like a Laplace transformation, only we have discrete spacing, so we need a discrete version of it. Now when we are in a generic case, that means this is non-degenerate, then the endpoint function takes this form. We have some number here, and the eigenvalues of the transfer matrix, they enter in this fashion. That's the exponent from the E matrix.
What was J of E again?
The Jordan transform version of the transfer matrix. Okay.
Does it mean the eigenvalues of the transfer matrix are all distinct? I don't understand.
Yes, of course, if it's non-degenerate.
Is that the meaning of the... Is that the meaning of JE being non-degenerate?
Yes, precisely. Okay, now if we apply the Z transform to the correlators of this kind, then we get this kind of function, simply a geometric series if you want. And we have these numbers, the residues, and we have these poles in the n minus one fold complex plane. This is a meromorphic function. The poles and the residues are characteristic for it. So what we have to know to reconstruct the endpoint function are the poles, because then we know this, and the residues, then we know this. The residues actually can be derived from the M matrix and from the left eigenvalues of the E matrix in the following form. This is a number here. This is another number. They are all multiplied. And essentially, the same applies to the associated field states. There are non-lattice versions of the MPS, which can be seen as states of quantum fields. And if there is some time later, I will come to this. One has almost the same situation for them. I mean, not all matrices have are symmetric, right, or Hermitian. Yes. And then you can define eigenvalues from the left and from the right, which I don't know. It exists, okay. But and also for the other side, but they are not Hermitian conjugates of each other. Okay. And now to see how we derive what the connection between all the endpoint functions is, let me just give you an example instead of the full theorem. Okay, imagine we have the following case. MPS is generic and has finite D, okay? Then another constraint is that the operators are such that the M matrix derived from it, conjugated with the matrix that takes E to the Jordan normal form, has only non-zero elements. One can imagine this is almost always the case. And now, because they are all non-zero, all two-point functions show all the poles, because the poles here are matrix elements of the M matrix, and if they are all different from zero, then we will see all the poles in the Z transform of the two-point function.
Sorry, the M's are the same as the O's, is that right?
Not entirely. They are constructed with help of the E matrix. Here. M is the matrix of the operator O enters, but it is modified. Oh. So we can plug it into this trace.
But it depends on the...
On the state.
On O.
On O, yes. You see, maybe it's too fast. Here. I mean, is a matrix element of O.
I mean, if you change one O...
If you change the O...
There's an O. That's on. Never mind.
But you can change the O. Then you get different M's for each O. You get different. Yeah, and now, okay, because we see all the poles, we see all the residues. And now let me give you D squared versions of the one. Namely, I mean, we can write the one, normal one, an element of C, depending on K, as such a quotient. The C2K is the pole of the two-point function. It is, the residue of the kth pole of the two-point function, and it is a product of these matrix elements. So what I'm writing here is something divided by itself. So it's one, but here it's expressed in form of the matrix elements, and here I call it C2. Now, to see what's happening, we take as an example a pole of the four-point function, which is by definition this product of the M matrix elements, and we enter these ones in between. And then we put brackets around it in a nice fashion. This here cancels. Then we see, oh, this pole of the four-point function is actually given by this formula, which involves only the poles of the three-point functions and the two-point functions. This, in similar form, carries over to all poles of all endpoint functions. So this is the relation between them. So you have the Z transform of the endpoint functions. You know where the poles are because you know where they are in the two-point function. And then you have this funny connection between the residues of the poles of these Z transforms of the endpoint function. And this is a funny observation. It tells you basically that these entanglement limited states, which are close to ground states or even identical to ground states of these interacting local massive Hamiltonians, that they are like Gaussians, only a bit more complicated. But you can reduce everything to the two-point functions. So that's the technical result, basically. If there are any questions, I can ask them. And for the rest of my talk, I want to go into what we think are implications, at least one of the implications, namely the diagrammatic methods. I mean, I called this Wick's theorem for matrix product states. What's Wick's theorem? I mean, usually, say you go to the interaction picture and you make the Feynman approach, then the interaction in quantum field theories or also in other.
You get new poles? I didn't quite understand. When you go to the endpoint function, are there new poles or not?
Yes, of course.
And how do you know where they are? I thought you gave some formula for the residues or something.
Oh, yeah, but the poles are in these positions. So for the k's, which you know, you add poles in this fashion. You can construct. I mean, if you tell me, okay, what's the Z transform of the 17-point function? Then I know, okay, it will depend on 16 k's. For each k, I will have a pole in this position, I mean, formulated like this.
And what is
this mu?
What is mu?
This is the eigenvalue of the E matrix, and you can actually read it off from the two-point function, because the two-point function is already given by this. How did I write it? Z of the two-point function of S is sum over K, C2 of K divided by 1 minus mu K SK. You only have, of course, one S. So this is a totally normal complex meromorphic function. And you measure the two-point function in the experiment. It gives you the C2 of K, and it gives you the poles. Because you know where the poles are, you know what the mu's are. OK, that's settled. The mu's are known.
But then there's only a finite number of mu's.
Yes, the finite number is very decisive.
So there's only, even for the higher endpoint functions, there's only a finite number of, the same finite number.
The finite number is given by d square, where d was the hard limit to an entanglement, as you might remember. And we need this actually as a promise. Because matrix product states are so powerful, you can describe any state in terms of matrix product states. What is making this situation a bit special is that you say, OK, I want a matrix product state, but one where the matrix dimension is actually limited to a certain number. It can be as high as you want, depending on your Hamiltonian. It can be 1 million or whatever, or 10. But it must be limited, even for the thermodynamic case. This actually is linked to a decay of correlations. In a situation where you have non-exponentially decaying correlations, you will not find this limit. It's a problem. That's why I was always talking about these massive theories. The Hamiltonian must be gapped. But then it is actually mathematically well established that in this situation where the Hamiltonian is of a certain kind, that you can actually make this approximation and you are good.
So, okay. Maybe you're getting to it now. But, I mean, normally you think of this Wick's theorem as coming from some specially simple form of the Lagrangian, Hamiltonian.
Yeah, quadratic.
Quadratic.
Yes.
And then there's other situations where the three-point functions tend to determine everything, which is if there's some conformal symmetry or something. So So what is special here? Is there some analog of those, either of those pair?
I don't know. I mean, this is open research. This has been discovered only recently. And what the link, for example, to conformal view theories also is not entirely clear. But yeah, but usually, I mean, that's what I wanted to say here in the implication section. As you are right, I mean, you have this formal S matrix, and then you express everything in this in the free theory, right? You take the interacting part, interaction part, and you treat it as a disturbance to the free part. You express everything in the ground state of the free part. And the time-ordered products of these interaction terms here can then usually, this is only symbolless, yeah, right? I mean, field operators might vary, but basically you have these contracted two-point functions, the propagators. Yeah. So this is if you perturb away from a free theory. But what I wanted to say is that this should not be necessary here. You start with an interacting theory, and you have this connection between the endpoint functions also in the interacting theory, which is a bit surprising. I mean, I don't know if such a result exists. For conformal theories, yes. I mean, there you have this importance of these three-point functions, for example, and so on. But what the relation is to this is not entirely clear, to at least to me. If you want to discuss it later, I'd be happy. Okay. Now, yeah, as I said, these contracted things here in normal ordered form with a lot of combinatorics involved are the propagators, the two-point functions in the quasi-free means Gaussian vacuum states. And then what you develop from this is this mental image of virtual processes, right? You have the propagators, which are these lines. For example, you have a photon, and you say, okay, multiplying this together. And so it means particle moves from here to there, meets another particle, annihilates. Photon comes out, goes somewhere else, and so on. So your mental image that you make out of this mathematical formalism is this virtual particle picture, which we take, in principle, very serious. Okay. Now, one of the problems with this is, I mean, sometimes it works well. Sometimes these series expansions are problematic. The quasi-free theory is very different from the interacting theory, also from a mathematical point of view. And then there is, of course, the question of representations and what these series represent. What kind of mathematical object is it? Haag's theorem and so on. These things come to mind. Maybe one can investigate it in the light of our new Wick theorem. So this is what I wanted to suggest. One could, for example, start a perturbation approach like as usual.
I mean, the usual Wick's theorem, we know how to get the endpoint functions from the two-point function. Did you show us that?
I mean, yes.
It's all indirect in terms of these poles and everything like
yeah.
that. But is there any simple formula analogous to
Not
that?
Yet. You are welcome to find one. I mean, I noticed this connection between the poles of the Z transforms, but what kind of algebraic structure is hidden behind this is open. Also, one has to, of course, perform time development. I was not talking about time here, but of course, this time can be generated by the Hamiltonian, which can be expressed in endpoint functions, which can be expressed in two and three-point functions again, and so on. It's a bit messy, but I mean, the main message here is that basically you are only talking about something that comes from the two and three-point functions. The end of the day. Yeah. So, of course, the obvious way to proceed would be to evaluate the S matrix with our approach and then see what the virtual processes and so on come out. What they are. One can apply this to, for example, quantum wires, one-dimensional quantum situations. You could do it in an experiment. You could try to find out what the algebra tells you. And then in the end, go home and say, our picture with the plasmons, magnons, or whatever colliding here is misleading. What we are really looking at is some other mental image being derived from the three-point functions. I mean, this would be nice to have, right? And one could apply it here with some algebra. I mean, there are obvious questions. I mean, I told you how to, for example, come up with the poles of the residues of the four-point function. We have this relation. I mean, in the real Wick theorem, you had this multiplication of the two-point functions, expectation values thereof. Very easy. It's like linking lines and so on. Here you have divisions and so on. As C2 might be related to the field equation. But why is the three-point function coming in here at all? I mean, what could it be in terms of the virtual particle picture? Why three? It's opaque. Then what kind of diagrams do we get out? I mean, as I said, Feynman diagrams, for example, they really form our image of what's going on when we have scattering or so. I would be interested to see what's going on this level here. I have no idea, though. And can we find simple diagrammatic expressions and so on? Also, very interesting for the relevance of this ansatz is if we can at least carry over the essentials of this MPS ansatz to situations where we have more than one dimension in space. There are versions of MPS in this regime, but they are computationally not accessible. The construction is straightforward. You get mathematical expressions, so-called PEP states. However, for example, in very simple instances of these PEP states, one can actually perform universal quantum computation. As the quantum computer is believed to be a very powerful machine, much more powerful than the classical computers and stuff we use on paper, calculations on paper, it might be very difficult to find an extension where you can actually have a grip on the algebraic structure. Would maybe imply that you get a better understanding of the dynamics of the quantum computer, which is basically, of course, just a quantum system evolving. But yeah. So the 2D situations that are similar to those that I showed you are known to be quite demanding in terms of understanding. So thank you for your attention. And if you'd like to read about it, there's this PRL and the archive version. They should be identical. And if you, I can go on a bit if you want about the associated field states in one dimension. Maybe it's interesting for people who are not interested in spin chains, but quantum fields. I don't know. Depends. There are some more slides. Yeah? Okay. I happen to have prepared this. Okay, the CMPS can be derived from the normal MPS via a limiting procedure. In principle, you make these. Oh, let me show you something. Okay. What
there's
you have here?
There's some buttons there. If you press them, you can raise and lower.
Ah, sure. Okay, mid, no. It's.
Doesn't work?
I don't understand it. But anyway. Ah, okay. You just have to tell it what you want to have in front. No. Ah, nice. Okay. I mean, you have this construction. Now, what you would like to obtain a field state is to make let this new go to infinity. Okay, so you have an expression like this. And this, this has to be meaningful. So what do you do? I mean, we know something like it. Um, So in principle, it's very easy. You take this, you make this A very weak, 1 plus something, 1 plus order of epsilon. Okay, and this epsilon, you can also say this is, say you create something in place U and so on, and you act on the vacuum. Okay, then you link these A matrices to creation operators. A bit epsilontic. And you find out that you are actually dealing with a path-ordered integral here.
So what is omega in this state?
Omega is the vacuum.
Okay. So, but this is not Hermitian and the power of exponent.
No, that's true. You could add the complex conjugate of this thing, but acting on the vacuum annihilates it.
And what's no point. The meaning of Q and R?
Yeah, Q and R are the remnants of the A matrices. A0, belonging to no excitation at all, will be will be something like this, which is very similar to this E thing. But then, of course, we want excitations. And this U, I think, you do it like this. And for reasons of continuity, because if you, I mean, this is just a name for the deviation from 1 and 0. The point is, the higher excitations have to depend somehow on the first excitation, because you can create particles arbitrarily close, and they should be, the result should be very similar to if you create something on the same place. So two excitations in the same place should be very similar to two excitations very close to each other. And so you get that An is simply, I hope I'm not making a mistake here with some kind of, but it looks like this for continuity reasons. And
so
then?
Is it correct to say that R is sort of cut off version of the creation operator?
No, not R. The creation operator is contained here. That's a weird thing. R is simply linked to it. Like A was linked to creation processes in this spin picture. Okay, then you get some picture like this. Path ordered integral.
What is L?
L is the length of this, the dimension. I mean, it's a circle of a perimeter, finally, L. Okay. You can let this L go to infinity, of course, which is something that we want.
Well, what's physical meaning?
Well, yeah. I mean, this field lives on a circle. And Q and R are also matrices which have limited dimension. Okay. So, now, the correlation function is in a way very analogous to this, then written in this form. You have also these M matrices, and then the transfer operators are E to the transfer matrix. The transfer matrix is given by this expression, and it's an analogous version of, I didn't write it, of this sum over A star S tensor A S. Just the same thing. Okay. And now, of course, these matrices that enter are, if you plug in creation or annihilation operators here, this is the normal ordered form. I mean, you define your state in terms of expressions of the normal ordered application of annihilation and creation operators plus this commutation relation. This then defines the state. And for this normal ordered things, which are the non-trivial parts of this definition, you get this expression. I mean, you could also say, I define a field theory on a circle just by using these expressions. The relation, the limiting process to the MPS, that gives you a sort of a feeling that it somehow might belong to some kind of meaningful quantum theory. Because if you just write this down, I mean, just an expression, but it's the limit version of an NPS, which is well understood and known to be a relevant class of states.
So can you reconstruct electrodynamics?
Electrodynamics? It's okay. That's something we are working on. I mean, to put a relativistically covariant version of a quantum theory here, one has to, of course, modify the... one has to have a good understanding of the commutation relation and the transformation properties and so on. And it's not so clear if this works here. Also, one further thing connected to this limiting process and so on. I personally think it is not singular enough. These Weidman distributions, if you want, they are too nice. The state lives on the Fock vacuum, on the Fock space of the vacuum state, with the usual free particle creation annihilation operators. So that already tells you a bit about what kind of theory this might be. So I doubt this is really the ground state of an interacting field theory, at least not in the relativistic case. So if you want to go to electrodynamics or something like this, you would have to make this definition more singular. But it might be possible to do so, and this is ongoing research. So,
how about the ground state of a free theory? Take a free theory, what about its ground state?
The free theories, they belong to Gaussian states. So if you want to express a Gaussian state in this form, you have to take very large matrices. Infinitely large matrices.
Oh.
So, and
if you can't get the free theory, how would you hope to get the interaction?
I mean, in a way, the interacting theory is so far away from the free theory that why would you expect to get the free theory in this thing? I mean, they are both limiting points, so to say, in the set of states, which are not really well connected. But
The interacting theory might be easier to solve than the free one.
I mean, if you take this ansatz, might be, yes.
So this refers to what? It refers to non-relativistic, but is it interacting or non-interacting?
The question, is it interacting? I don't know. Of course, you would like to know the Hamiltonian.
Yeah.
Yeah. And for matrix product sets, it's very easy to construct the parent Hamiltonians. I haven't tried to construct the parent Hamiltonian for such a state. But I doubt it, it really belongs to the class of these hard interacting theories. And from this construction, it will not be relativistic. So one would have to modify this ansatz a bit to accommodate really important physical theories. But maybe it's possible. And maybe one should actually do it the other way around. Take this Wick theorem that I'm proposing here and to guide yourself through the construction process. So maybe not take this picture. This is maybe too easy, too smooth, too nicely behaved. But maybe take the Wick theorem that we propose. And then define Weidman functionals, Weidman distributions with the properties that the NPS have, and then see what comes out. Something like this. But this is just an idea, so I haven't tried it. Okay, now this is straightforward and very similar. I mean, just to show you how we come up with a similar structure as in the discrete case. I mean, you have these expressions for the endpoint functions, and then you would now do the real Laplace transform. And you have a very similar structure. The e to the eigenvalues of the T matrix appear here, and the Laplace transform of such a thing is now like this. Again, poles, residues. residues exactly in the same form as before. Okay, that's it. You have the same relations. So the field theory limit of the matrix product sets are very similar. Yeah. Now that you know these expressions, I can show you something which is not high energy physics related or so, but still nice to have. Namely, open quantum systems. You know that if you have a finite level system in your lab, an atom or so, and it's interacting with something outside, or maybe the photons or so are leaking out, then you know you can describe it like this with a new Hubbellian. This is the unitary evolution that you are used to. And this is an additional term, which is this leaking out of the closed system. So this is an open system. And now with some simple rewrite of the density matrix, we can actually reformulate this thing in this form. And the Q matrix is actually related to the Hamiltonian of the system here. Yeah. If one writes it like this, one has that this Hubbellian matrix has this form. Oh, it's the propagator of our, or this pseudo propagator transfer matrix of our CMPS. So the CMPS has an interpretation in the following form. The finite level system that you have is an atom or whatever, spin, finite level system. And it flies through the room. And it has an internal dynamics given by H. And now you have an interaction going on with the vacuum or whatever along its path. And the interaction Hamiltonian is this R tensor psi dagger plus R dagger tensor psi. And it leaves traces in the field from its own internal dynamics plus the interaction. And this field will, because of the nature of its generation process, or generating process, will have a certain internal structure. This structure is described now by the CMPS. On the other hand, if it's not flying through the room, but in a trap and light is leaking out, then you might say, okay, I have a finite level system that's doing something. Light beam comes out. The light beam has the structure of the CMPS. Okay, this is some nice side effect. This is related to this field reconstruction thing. It's important for quantum optics. If you want to detect what's going on in your trap, you might try to find this R and Q matrix that is related to your field structure that you observe. And then you might deduce what the internal dynamics of your atom is, or whatever you're observing. This is something that I want to do in the future. Yeah, OK, maybe I'm not going to the most general case here. It's too much intention. So the time is very advanced, 1 hour, OK? Yeah. So thanks for your attention.
Questions?
I'm trying to figure out how should I think of the S matrix in that case, because in normal field theory, I now get infinity as if they're non-interacting, so I just sort of localize part which I describe with the S matrix interaction. Here I have already strongly interacting theory to start with. Is this some kind of physical intuition I could have about the S matrix?
Yeah, it's this is one of the hard parts, of course. Like figuring out what the, I mean, to get a grip on the algebraic structure that might be connected to it. I think it's related. See, okay, what are these processes, right? What's going on? Yeah, that's one of the more difficult endeavors here. Mm.
Do you have any more thoughts on what diagrammatic structure would correspond to this? Because in the usual case, you get everything in the free series, you get everything with Gaussian states, you get everything from the two-point function. So that suggests lines, so it's a kind of graph. And then, so it's a Feynman diagram. Here, you're getting everything from the 3 point, not from 2.
That's true.
So even if we understood the localization, which I don't, but what kind of graphical structure could have this?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, of course, we are in a one-dimensional setting. Let's not forget this. And so a three-point function is basically something like this. What the three-point function tells you might be some kind of relation here. Namely, maybe you set a scale with this distance, which is somehow entering considerations related to this second thing. So maybe it's some kind of propagator two-point function with some included scale or something like this. But this is just a wild guess, I don't know. But this is, of course, one of the questions that come up. What is this?
I mean, I can't imagine what it, you could try and make a graph with triangles, some sort of.
Yeah, yeah, of course, but we are in one dimension, so it's, I mean, in one dimensions.
What if we go back to your, you had that formula for the seeds, which looked like, it looked like the definition of actually of a Markov process, that formula. Suppose that was the only pole. Could you say I don't know, is this an identity for the three-point function? This looks like you're getting the three-point function.
No, it's not a three-point function, it's one of its poles in the Z, after the Z transform.
I think I'm lost. What are these Ks?
The Ks are numbers that are labels of the poles.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. So you have...
there are three different poles?
Yes, in the four-point function, you have 4 points. Between them, you have three distances.
Oh, the denominator has 3 poles, and this is the 4 poles.
Okay. Yeah. 3 distances means 3 complex variables. And in each of these complex planes, you have one, okay, you have a set of poles which are labeled by these Ks.
Okay,
I can show you more.
Suppose that was the only.
This instructive way. See, you have n's here, distances. N minus one distances.
Yeah, that's okay. I don't want to take too much time.
No.
So if you go back to that formula, suppose that that was the only pole that occurred in the four-point function, and that those other poles were the only poles that occurred in the three-point function, in the two-point function.
This is not possible, because we have, in the non-trivial case, at least two by two matrices, which implies already...
No, it can't be really possible, but you could just write your inverse Laplace transform, or whatever you called it, just isolating the contribution of that pole. I mean, what I'm trying to get at is I'm wondering if it was that simple, could you then go back to position space or whatever you call it? I don't know what to call it, but the untransformed space.
Oh yeah, once you have this, you can always go back.
Could you go back to that? Could you then, in space and not in momentum space?
I'll give this formula in this other.
Yeah, give a formula relating to 2-point, 3-point, and 4-point functions.
Maybe. I haven't tried. But of course, it would involve going back and forth between the both pictures. And if you want to let this enter into this formula for the 4-point, no problem. I mean, again, I have this. I mean, I have this formula here for the endpoint function where this simply enters as a number. I could, of course, replace it with the appropriate expressions. But to replace it with these numbers, I would have to transform 2 and 3-point functions first, because these are just...
No, but this is telling you to take some sort of Fourier transform, or whatever you call that. But if you actually take it, if you really do take the Fourier transform, using just that simple ansatz for the 4-point function, would you get something simple? something?
No, I don't think so. No, I mean, no. Actually, I mean, there have been efforts in our group to use the CMPS case for the reconstruction of field states that come out of a trap or so. And from the tomographic perspective, it doesn't seem to be so easy how everything enters. I mean, okay, maybe we have overlooked something.
But I'm saying just look at one pole. Don't look at all the other poles.
Yeah, okay.
And just do the transform for that one.
Yeah, then you would
suppose
have...
Suppose that CN was just given, or I don't know whatever you call it, CN, I guess, was just given by that one rational function, which was just some numerator over these poles that you know about.
Ah, yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. I see.
Can you then undo the... Then you ought to be able to undo this. You ought to be able to get C at the left-hand side explicitly as a function of M.
If there's only one, then maybe... But if there are more, then you have to sort of figure out which one to take. It's all better. I don't know.
Well, you have a sum. Some of them. Or it's, I don't know. It could be completely wrong. But I'm thinking of it something like, you know, you identify a resonance with a pole or something. There might be many poles.
I mean, here, what enters, I mean, this is, okay, I mean, C2 times mu to the n. This is something that enters, that's your two-point function.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, no, the two-point function. This is capital C. And this is only one distance. That is small c. Okay, you say only one pole, that means
only one
k. Okay.
Yes, only one.
Then you could find something. But what I'm saying is, okay, if you have the sum, you have to find it, and this is the this is always the case. You always have a sum. Otherwise, you have no information about distance in your state. With a one-by-one matrix, the state is, doesn't contain any distances because all the matrices commute, right? And if all matrices commute, you cannot implement the distance between them. So you have to have at least two-by-two matrices. But that leaves you with the task of figuring out in this place which of these summons to take. And I say this involves integrating around poles, curves, or even analytic continuation things like this. So I doubt it's a very simple expression, but okay, I will think about it. It's, it might be an ansatz to understand it.
Okay, so maybe we should end the official part here and discuss furthermore with some tea or something later on. So let's thank Robert again. Thank you.